other than Mr. Mitchell.
Morgan also criticized Mitchell for a 2015 audit that scrutinized the union's spending and a $38,000 payment to a former union office employee. Mitchell didn't respond directly to any of the allegations. Instead, he released a statement calling them an attack on first responders. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers beat the San Diego Padres 8-4 last night. Meanwhile, the Cubs are losing to Kansas City 9-0, so the Cubs' lead over the Brewers shrinks to 1.5 games in the NL Central. The White Sox lost to the Yankees 7-3. Tonight, the Brewers host San Diego again at Miller Park. Cubs and White Sox are off. Northwoods League Baseball, the Kenosha Kingfish beat the Rockford Riveters 8-2 last night at Simmons Field. The Fish play in Kalamazoo tonight. NFL preseason football tonight at 7 o'clock. The Packers take on the Tennessee Titans. That'll be on Channel 4. The Bears play the Cincinnati Bengals at 6 o'clock. That's on Channel 32. The forecast now from the National Weather Service looks like this. Partly sunny, hot, and humid today. 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. A high of 89, heat index near 95. Right now, humidity 84%, wind from the west at 8, 76 degrees in Racine, 74 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am very excited and honored to be speaking for the second time with Bill Schneider, very well known as a longtime senior political analyst for CNN, now a professor at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. The first occasion of our first conversation was just ahead of his visit to Carthage College. And we are talking today because of his newest book, which is called Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. And in this book, published by Simon & Schuster, Bill Schneider analyzes the way in which America has become so ferociously divided. What is the nature of that divisiveness? Is there any way out of it? And how did we get here? Bill Schneider, we welcome you back to the morning show.
My pleasure.
I really have enjoyed your book, and there's all kinds of things for us to be talking about. One of them, which you explore early in the book, is an interesting notion that the American government, the way it is set up, is almost inherently going to be prone to the kind of gridlock that we actually see quite often. And one of the ways in which you make your point is by contrasting it with the government of Britain, which you say is built in a very different way, in a sense, to really safeguard from gridlock. Explain how our government was created in a way that almost makes gridlock to some extent inevitable.
What we have is a system, the federal system, is weak government. The writers of the Constitution back in the 18th century distrusted strong government because they had just fought a revolution against the king, who they thought was tyrannical and abusive, and they did not want a strong federal government. In fact, the first Constitution they wrote, the Articles of Confederation, provided such a weak government that it collapsed. It could not continue. After about 7 years, it was tossed out, and the Constitution of the United States was written, and it was written with checks and balances, separation of power, limitations on the power of the president, the Congress, the courts. All of those things were used to check and balance each other, so none of them could have too much power. It was done deliberately for that purpose. The British government has been called an elected dictatorship. Once a British government is in office, it can do anything it wants because the prime minister carries a majority in the parliament. and it produces a much stronger government. So it's a very different system. Let me tell you something. In Britain, gridlock is unconstitutional. It can't be allowed. If there's gridlock and the government can't govern, it violates a principle of the British Constitution, which is Her Majesty's government must be carried on. If the government can't function, ours gets locked up all the time. But in Britain, if the government can't function, they shut down Parliament and they have a new election and keep voting and voting until they get a government that can govern.
Hmm. I want you to try to characterize the level of gridlock and divisiveness which we are seeing right now in the United States. I mean, there have been times in our history when we have been sharply and painfully divided. Have we been this painfully divided before as a nation?
Students ask me that all the time. Is this the most divided we've ever been as a country? My answer to them and to you is we did once have a civil war, and 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War, many of them from disease or starvation. Thank God that we're not at that point yet, but I'd say this is the most divided we have been since the Civil War, and it's not a sudden division. It didn't happen because of Donald Trump. It goes all the way back to the 1960s when we began to see a division of values take over the country.
Right.
You know, there's two ways people get divided: interests and values. Interests are things like a division between business and labor, where they have conflicting interests. That was what politics was all about 100 years ago. But differences of interest can be compromised. They can be negotiated. Differences of values are about right and wrong. And in the book, I describe a new America that's emerged to challenge the values of the old America. And at this point, they've really reached the standoff. The two sides are unwilling and unable to compromise. And so that really means government has become far more difficult than it ever has been.
Right. So we are talking about a division largely based on differences in values rather than differences in people's own interests. Talk more about this divide of old America and new America and why you are choosing to characterize it with that kind of language. What is old about old America? What is new about new America?
What is old about old America is a belief in traditional American values, which have really been enforced since the beginning of the Republic. Limited government is one of those values. Traditional values. Religion is central to the old America. The new America just began to emerge in the 1960s, and it has a commitment to diversity and inclusion. In the old America, which includes now Donald Trump, who embodies old American values, they are skeptical of diversity and inclusion. They think it means political correctness, and they hate political correctness. Those two sides have reached an impasse over a lot of issues, cultural issues like abortion rights and gay rights, things like that. That division has been getting stronger and stronger ever since it first started in the 1960s, and it's reached the point now where we really are at a standoff.
We'll talk more about President Trump, I think, later in the conversation, but let me just ask about something you just said about President Trump embodying the values of old America. I think some people would probably push back at that, saying that somebody who has been divorced twice and kind of lived the life that he has is not a perfect embodiment of the values of old America. But obviously he speaks to the people who embrace the values of old America very, very powerfully. Can you help us make sense of that?
Yes, his behavior, his so-called lifestyle, is hardly what you would call the old American lifestyle. He's not a particularly religious man, nor was Ronald Reagan, for that matter, but they both articulated the values of traditional America, including religion. One thing that really struck me was that Trump has a base. His base includes a lot of the religious right, religious conservatives. What they admire about him isn't his lifestyle or even his personal values. It's the fact that he delivers for them. The one issue they care about more than anything else are the courts. And Trump has so far delivered one Supreme Court justice who's now seated, Justice Gorsuch, and a second one, Justice Kavanaugh, who's being considered for confirmation. while the religious right is deliriously happy with those appointments, with those nominations. He has done what other presidents were unable to do. He is building a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. The reason Trump is valued by his base, by his supporters, is he is a rule breaker who can get things done. He delivers, and that's what they like him for.
We're speaking with Bill Schneider about his new book called Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable. As a senior political analyst at CNN, you were engaged in charting and analyzing public opinion. You say a lot of interesting things in your new book about public opinion, and I think one of the most interesting is when you say public opinion is often misunderstood. Its importance is typically either overestimated or underestimated. That's a really intriguing thing to say. How can both things be true, or in what way do we both over and underestimate the importance of public opinion and what it's all about?
Well, we overestimate it when we assume that it means the people will always get their way. They don't always get their way. Majorities are, in most constituencies in this country, in favor of gun control. But even after Sandy Hook, we couldn't get gun control. Well, there's a reason for that I explain in the book. It's because public opinion matters, but loud opinions matter more. And what you have is a constituency of gun rights activists who are a minority, but they are a loud minority, and loud voices matter more. They have intensity on their side. While the gun control constituency has the numbers, the gun activists have activism and commitment on their side. That is the way that it is underestimated. Public opinion can shape a lot of issues, and it has in this country. We saw it happen way back in 2000 with the Elian Gonzalez episode, where people said to politicians, don't let politics interfere with what is a personal tragedy. It should be left to the family. And when politicians started to interfere to try to get the child kept in the United States, there was a huge backlash, and people paid a price for that. Hmm.
You point out the shift in opinion in terms of same-sex marriage, that as people began to know people in their own lives, and suddenly there was a little harder to think of gays as the other people, public opinion shifted dramatically on this issue, which once sharply divided many Americans. The shift was quite rapid, actually.
It was, and it happened in a record period of time. It took about maybe 10 years for people to support same-sex marriage. And the reason that people did that, I write in the book, is the number of Americans who say, I know someone who is openly gay, a friend, a relative, a coworker. That number has skyrocketed. Back in the 70s, when people were first polling on this and asking, do you know someone who is openly gay, the numbers were in the 20s, 27%, I recall. But now it's over 70% in the polls. What's happened is a lot of gays have come out of the closet, they're identified, and what you're finding is what I call the Dick Cheney effect. His daughter is gay, she lives with another woman, they have a child. It's very difficult. Dick Cheney said he wouldn't discriminate against gay people. He thought the issue should be left to the states to decide how they want to do it. More and more Americans know someone gay, and that makes it very difficult to discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. And it's changed extremely rapidly. You know, politicians did not lead on the issue of same-sex marriage. Obama didn't oppose it, didn't support it until very late. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton didn't support it until very late. They didn't lead the people. The people led them.
Hmm. Let's talk for a moment about the polarization that you tell us really began back in the 1960s. And in some ways you say the difference between old America and new America is if you didn't like what happened in the 60s, you're old America. If you welcomed those changes, you're new America. You pose a very interesting question in the midst of that discussion when you ask, why was that divide so deep in the United States? Why was it such a deep division and such an enduring division compared to other countries? Is there an answer to that question?
I think there is, and I point to it in the book. The answer, the most simple way to put it, is religion. The United States of America is the most religious, advanced industrial society in the world. Americans go to church more, believe in religion, believe in heaven and hell and angels and Satan and the Bible more than any people in any industrial country. And that's distinctive to the United States, and there's a reason for it. Many people originally settled in the United States for reasons of religious freedom. They didn't want to live in Europe under an established church. So they came here, as the Puritans did in the 17th century. They came to the United States in order to exercise their religion freely, and that meant for generation after generation, those religious values have remained very, very strong. And that is one of the core divisions between the old America and the new America. We see fights over religious freedom all the time. People who resist same-sex marriage, refuse to serve same-sex couples, won't bake them a cake or send arrange flowers for a wedding ceremony, those are people who claim that being forced to serve same-sex couples violates their religious freedom. Religion is at the key of a lot of things.
So there is this polarization between old America and new America, and one of the things that you point to as an indication of that is in our two major political parties, likening them to tents, T-E-N-T-S, to tents that are getting smaller in terms of who they are interested in including and who they are willing to exclude from the tent. It's such an interesting picture, and at a glance, it would seem to make no sense that if you want your own political party to be successful, it seems to make sense to make it as big a tent as possible, so as many people as possible can be within it. And yet, there are other forces at work here that are obviously running counter to that assumption. Explain why it makes sense for these tents, in a sense, to be smaller.
Well, they have a more coherent ideology. Their values are more consistent. That's true principally in the Republican Party, but increasingly in the Democratic Party. Republicans are moving to the right, clearly under Donald Trump, and Democrats are beginning to move to the left. People like Bernie Sanders and the woman Ocasio-Cortez, who won the primary in the Bronx, she's traveling around the country promoting progressive candidates with her mentor, that's Bernie Sanders. A lot of people on the left think Bernie Sanders was cheated out of victory in 2016, and they're putting pressure on Democrats to move to the left. That's becoming a bigger and bigger phenomenon. What we're seeing is parties, historically in this country, are coalitions. In a coalition, you only ask one question. Do you support the Republican candidate? If you do, you're one of us. No more questions. But these days, Republicans insist on having candidates who agree with them on gun control, who agree with them on trade, who agree with them on foreign policy. They have to agree on everything, and the tests have become much more vigorous. And the result is that we have fewer Republicans, fewer Democrats, and a larger growing number of independents.
But I suppose the what they gain is, in a sense, intensity and ferocity. I mean, with a more focused message by excluding those who can't align with them on all of these different points. And again, we're talking about this potentially on both sides of the aisle. I want you to talk about something you spend quite a lot of time talking about in the book when you are talking about this hardening of party lines. You say that one of the ways we can chart this and the way that this has occurred since the end of World War II is in public presidential job ratings. And the numbers tell a really interesting story, although only if we understand the numbers and what's behind them. Explain how this can be kind of a barometer to measure the hardening of party lines.
Well, the Gallup poll has been asking people, do you approve or disapprove of the job the president is doing? And what we're finding is, over the last 75 years, if you compare approval of the president's performance in the president's party and approval in the opposition party, those figures have gotten farther and farther apart. Now, today, with Donald Trump, they're about 60 points, 70 points apart. About 80%, now it's close to 90% of Republicans approve Donald Trump. Fewer than 10% of Democrats approve Donald Trump. It did not used to be like that. Back in the 1960s, when Lyndon Johnson was president, he did reasonably well with his own party, but there was a lot of opposition to him, and he got a considerable amount of support from Republicans. But the distance between the two parties about each president and about many issues has grown wider and wider and wider for the last 70 years. And Trump got elected by taking advantage of that division.
Right. We'll talk about him again in just a moment. Ahead of that, you spend a lot of time in the book talking about intensity. About intensity of opinion on perhaps a given issue or about a given person. One of the things you say in the book is that polling has had a what you call a dirty little secret. Polls do not measure intensity of opinion very well. Take us inside that, why that is so, and if there's anything we can do about that. Because, of course, obviously, intensity really matters.
It does. And polls usually count noses. They say on an issue like abortion rights, do you support abortion rights or oppose them? And we get a count of the number of people on each side. But what politicians want to know isn't just how many people support abortion rights or oppose abortion rights, but how many people on each side of that issue really vote the issue. Does it drive their vote? Do they feel so intense about it that they will never vote for someone who disagrees with them? Well, the intensity factor helps the anti-abortion side on that issue. They feel more strongly about it. The same is true with guns and gun control. If I'm a politician, let's say someone takes a poll of my constituency and finds that 70% of the people that I represent favor gun control, well, the politician will probably listen politely to those numbers and say, thank you very much, and still not vote for gun control, even if it's a majority of his or her constituents. The reason is the politicians know that while gun activists may be a minority in their constituency, they will vote the issue because they feel very intensely about it. They are never going to vote for someone who disagrees with them on that issue. Whereas in the larger group, the majority, who support gun control measures, that is not the single issue that drives their vote. So the politician could lose 25% of the vote among gun activists, who are just a quarter of his constituents, and not gain very many votes from the majority who agree on that issue, because it's not an issue that drives the vote.
That is not the deal breaker. That single issue is not a deal breaker, although it's possible at some point that might change, but for the moment that remains the situation.
It usually changes only after a sensational incident of gun violence. Right for a month or so after an incident of gun violence, like the tragedy at Sandy Hook, gun control advocates were demanding that tougher laws be passed, and sometimes they are. But the gun rights constituency is active all the time, and they're very, very watchful on their issue. They say, if you vote for gun control, we're going to come after you, and we're going to throw you out of office for that reason alone, because we don't care about what else you say or what else you do. If you're not with us on the gun issue, we're going to throw you out of office.
In our closing minutes, let's talk about the current president. You say nothing captures the breakdown of American politics more than the election of Donald J. Trump. Explain how that is so.
Donald Trump didn't create the division of the country. It's been there and growing ever since the 60s. But Donald Trump exploited it. He did something that no president before him, except maybe Andrew Jackson. There was no polls in those days. And he has a picture of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office. He put it there. No president has ever gotten elected for the explicit purpose of dividing the country or keeping it divided. Not even Abraham Lincoln, who famously, when he was president, tried to reconcile the country. Trump is a businessman. He saw an opportunity to get elected, and he took it. He ran on a platform that divided the country. He got elected as a divider, and he's governing as a divider, which is one reason why we have such intense feelings about Donald Trump. It's something we haven't seen before. He follows four presidents in a row who promised to heal the country's division. And you know what? They all failed. The first President Bush said he would be kinder and gentler after Ronald Reagan. He lasted one term. Bill Clinton was New Democrat and the Third Way, he wanted to heal the country. He got impeached. The second Bush, when he declared himself a candidate for president, he said, I intend to be a uniter, not a divider. But when the Iraq war got underway, the country got more bitterly divided than ever. And Barack Obama said, there's no liberal America, there's no conservative America. Well, it turned out he was wrong. Donald Trump never proposed to govern as a healer, and he hasn't.
You write, the difference between Trump and his predecessors is that Trump deliberately foments division. He uses every issue, every policy, every tweet to set one group of Americans against another. He thrives on political confrontation. The result is a level of bitterness and resentment the United States has not seen since the Civil War. What is that going to mean come November?
Well, come November, I think what we're going to experience is what I call a base election. You're going to have a showdown between the conservative base of the Republican Party, which has been taken over by Donald Trump and is strongly supportive of Trump, and the increasingly liberal base of the Democratic Party. In a base election, the experience is bitter. It's often ugly. The election this year, I call the war between the bases, and it's poisoning our politics. Because the two sides can't get together and compromise when you have a division of values. Each party basically has a mandate to destroy what the other party did. And you see that right now with Donald Trump, who's trying to eradicate every single law, every single regulation that his predecessor, Barack Obama, put into effect. What we're going to witness is cycles of lunging political revenge, each side waiting to gain power so that it can eradicate everything the other side did. No more compromise, no negotiations.
Is there any way out of this?
Yes, it's worked in the past. If there is a tremendous national crisis, something no one would wish for, but in periods of great national crisis, the public really forces politicians to compromise, to come together, to govern effectively. There are many issues out there that people think are national crises, but they're really not, because the power of public opinion isn't really there. One of them is climate change, global warming. Everyone acknowledges that that's a problem, not everyone, but almost everyone. But yet it's not a big enough problem that people say, do something, raise the gas tax, do something to solve this terrible problem. And on the right, they think the national debt is an overwhelming problem. Do something, they say, to get rid of the national debt. Raise taxes. Cut entitlement spending. Well, Americans are not there yet. They worry about those problems, but those problems don't have the sense of urgency. This country, the dirty little secret of American politics is, if we have a real crisis in this country, the country can be governed because there's pressure for the parties to work together. But if an issue really isn't a crisis, and global warming is not really a crisis at this point for most voters, and the national debt is not really a crisis, if something is not a crisis, our system really can't function.
It's a very intriguing book. Again, Standoff, How America Became Ungovernable, published by Simon & Schuster, the author, Bill Schneider. Bill Schneider, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for writing such a provocative and fascinating book.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And the time is 8:38. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. Part two of The Morning Show today is out of The Morning Show archives, an interview that dates back to 2011.
We have recently celebrated the 100th birthday of a very important American, beloved by many, a former president, Ronald Reagan. And as we came to the landmark of 100 years after he was born, it of course set in motion many celebrations and retrospectives, and it was an opportunity to reassess this important American, whose life of course was amazingly varied, ranging of course from Hollywood icon to U.S. president. And part of the work of reassessing and celebrating the legacy of Ronald Reagan has been carried out by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation, and they have released a book called Ronald Reagan, 100 Years. It's a beautifully crafted book
which talks about the various facets of Ronald Reagan's life and his legacy. And we're going to be talking about it with the man responsible for the text, Mark Weinberg. This book, by the way, is published by Harper Design, an imprint of HarperCollins. Again, created under the auspices of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation. Mark Weinberg, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Good morning.
I'm so happy to have this opportunity to speak with you. You were telling me that this assignment, or this opportunity, I suppose we could call it both of those, came to you because you have had a long, close, affectionate association with the Reagan family. Tell us about your connection to them.
Well, I started off with the Reagans in the 1980 presidential campaign. And after President Reagan won, was invited to join the White House staff as a special assistant to the president and assistant White House press secretary, where I worked for all 8 years. And at the end of the administration, the Reagans asked if I would consider staying just a bit longer with them. So I went to California and for 2 years served as director of public affairs in former President Reagan's personal office in Los Angeles. So I was in their direct employ for 10 years, a little longer, and since then have remained active as a consultant and advisor and friend to the Reagan Foundation, the Reagan Library, the various entities that work to support his legacy.
How did you set about examining this life, which you probably already knew a great deal about, in even closer detail?
Well, you're right. The story hasn't changed much over the years. It's, you know, Ronald Reagan is a very well-known public figure, and there wasn't a lot that was new per se, except the pictures. There are a number of pictures in this book, I think, as folks look through it, that they hadn't seen before, which I hope they'll enjoy. But the idea of the text was to figure out a way to tell the entire story, the remarkable journey, in a readable, pleasant way that was approachable, that people at all levels and walks of life, whether they knew the story or not, could still learn something from and be interested in, and to make it all-encompassing, a one-size-fits-all of his entire life, from his birth in Illinois through the college years, the radio broadcasting years, the movie star years, the governorship, the presidency, and post-presidency. Because there have been a lot of books about various aspects of his life. The Hollywood years, the governor years, the White House years, the Gorbachev relationship. But what we wanted to do was to have something which kind of brought it all together where you could trace the whole journey and see the pictures that told the story as well.
Very good. I love how chapter one of the book is called The Lifesaver. I suspect most of our listeners know why this chapter would be called that, but say a word about that.
Well, one of the jobs that President Reagan had when he was quite young was as a lifeguard on the river in Illinois there, and he saved 77 people, pulled them out of the water, saved their lives. And what he used to do was he used to notch in a log a piece of wood there. Every time he saved a life, there would be another little notch in there. And over time, it counted up to 77 lives that he actually saved as a lifeguard. And there's a nice picture in the book of him wearing his lifeguard uniform. But he was quite a swimmer and quite proud of saving the lives of the folks there whose swimming skills weren't quite as good as his.
Hmm. Speaking of nice pictures, one of my favorite pictures in the book is of Ronald Reagan and some of his football teammates in Dixon, Illinois. And we see up close four football players kind of seated on the ground very informally. And the only one who's really smiling with an absolutely electric grin is young Ronald Reagan. And it's sort of a hint of what is to come, the great charisma that is evident even in this simple photograph.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a very keen observation that you make, because if you look at these pictures of him, one of the things that you will find more often than not is a smiling Ronald Reagan. And the reason for that is because this was a happy man. This was a man who enjoyed life, who loved his wife and children, who was thrilled to serve his country, who was happy to be an American, for whom life and the presidency were not a burden by any means, but a joy every day, and who was confident and optimistic. And there are a lot of us who think that was central to his success. The people felt that, and it came through, and it helped him lead this country.
One story about Ronald Reagan I had not ever heard until I read your book happened when he, during his first year, I believe, at Small Eureka College. Can you remind us of where that's located?
In Illinois, Central Illinois, Eureka College.
So not not terribly far from where he grew up then.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Not far from where he grew up.
You tell us a story about something that happened during his freshman year, and you call it his first taste of leadership. He was actually one of the students in charge of what turns out to be a fairly ferocious student protest. Can you tell us a little more about this story?
It was a strike, and the administration was doing some things of which he did not approve, with cutbacks and so forth, and the students didn't feel that the university administration was appropriating the funds in the right areas, that their priorities were out of sync with what the students thought they should be, and so they staged essentially a protest where they wouldn't come to class, they would pretend to be sick and things of that nature. And he went to one of the meetings for it with the other students, just as an interested student, and offered some opinions. And lo and behold, he did so in a way that was so moving and so articulate and so convincing that the students asked him if he wouldn't mind being a spokesman and a leader. And before he knew it, he essentially was one of the main figures in this campus protest, which lasted several days and ultimately led to a change in the administration of the entire university. Hmm. It's nothing he intended. He just found that the students responded to him and asked him to do this.
Hmm. In the chapter called Aspiring Star or Aspiring Actor, you tell us, among other things, about his interesting work as a radio announcer. And I think a few of these stories are already known to many in the public, but I certainly learned some fun things here as well. But let's proceed through that to the chapter called Leading Man, in
mm-hmm.
which we really see Ronald Reagan becoming the star that, now it sort of feels all predestined. But in fact, there was some good fortune involved as well in Ronald Reagan meeting the right people at the right time to propel his career forward in such exciting fashion.
That's right. You know, a lot of it's timing, luck, skill, a variety of factors. He knew he wanted to go in the acting business, in the motion picture business, but it wasn't such an easy path. He started off as a radio broadcaster for a team that just happened to do its spring training in California on Catalina Island. And he remembered a friend who he had worked with, who herself was an actress, and she said that she would get him an interview with her agent. He went to the interview with the agent, and the agent thought he was terrific, sent him over to Warner Brothers for a screen test. And even though he thought the screen test didn't go well, they liked him immediately and decided to sign him right away to a contract. But it was a series of events, unlikely events, and relationships which all kind of aligned at the right place at the right time. But the interesting part about it is when the people who knew what star quality was about came into contact with him, they knew immediately that they had something real there.
I thought you do a very good job of shedding some insight into what ultimately turned Ronald Reagan from Hollywood to another life that, of course, eventually involves politics on a very, very significant scale. You say that at least one of the factors involved, although he was always interested in politics, came in 1954 when his Hollywood career as a movie actor was not going terribly well, and he shifted his attention to television and was part of something called the General Electric Theater, an anthology program with a different story every week. And evidently this was a very good fit for Ronald Reagan, but some of the ancillary duties that were part of his hosting responsibilities are maybe part of what gave him a taste for the life of a politician. Can you tell us a little about that?
I think you're right. I think the GE years were the transformational years when he went from being a movie star, television celebrity, to being a national figure. Because what he would do as part of his responsibilities as host of GE Theater was to travel to GE plants all over the country and meet with their employees, everybody from the executives to the people on the line, and talk to them about what was going on in Hollywood, or so they thought. But what happened after a while was that he began to talk to them about broader issues, about our country and its future and working people and where we were going and some of the things that were on his mind and that were on their minds as well. And these goodwill tours turned into essentially a series of conversations and speeches about the issues that were confronting the country at the time. And what he found was that he was very comfortable with these topics, very interested in them, very passionate about them, and he found that the audiences were responsive, that you could see that something was happening. A relationship was beginning to develop between Ronald Reagan and people. And that's what moved him from the entertainment business into the public service business. Those GE tours over those years, when he started speaking to groups of people about issues, is what made the transition for him.
Tell our listeners about someone named Holmes Tuttle and a phone call that changes everything for Ronald Reagan.
Well, Holmes Tuttle was a wealthy auto dealer in Southern California and a very generous contributor to the Republican Party. And he and some others in California had heard Ronald Reagan speak at an event and thought that he had a charisma about him which could be utilized on behalf of the Republican Party in California, which was in a very bad shape at that time. And although it never occurred to Ronald Reagan to pursue a career in politics or to be a political figure, Holmes Tuttle and a few of the others who had been contributing to the Republican Party and been very concerned about its future in California approached him and said, listen, if we buy the airtime, if we pay for the time, would you be willing to make the speech that we just heard you make on national television on behalf of Barry Goldwater? This was in 1964, of course. And he said, well, yes, if you did that, why, if the Goldwater campaign wants me to do that, I would be willing to make that speech if you think it would be helpful. So they got together and they bought the time and booked a studio, and Ronald Reagan went into the studio and with a live audience in there, made this speech, which is known as the speech. It's the one where he speaks about having a rendezvous with destiny. It was the one that essentially put him on the map in terms of national politics. But the interesting thing about this is it almost didn't get made, because we write in the book that at the last minute, there was a phone call from the Goldwater people that said, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure this is a speech that's actually going to help here, because Ronald Reagan talks about issues that we've been trying to avoid, such as Social Security and so forth. And Reagan said, well, if it's not going to help, I sure don't want to do it. And Barry Goldwater said, no, wait a minute, I haven't actually heard the speech. Let me listen to the speech before it gets broadcast, and then we'll decide. And Reagan said, fair enough. So Barry Goldwater did. He listened to the speech and said, I don't see a thing in the world wrong with that. I think it's a wonderful speech. Go ahead. Well, the speech was broadcast, and the rest literally was history. Goldwater didn't win, of course, but a new political star was born, Ronald Reagan, and that led to his running for governor and down the road for president.
Hmm. And, of course, you have all kinds of interesting things to say about Ronald Reagan's two terms as a U.S. president. And, of course, much of what he also did and accomplished and meant to people in the years following. I am so...
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, you're right.
I'm so glad that your book includes the very eloquent, heartfelt letter, handwritten letter, from November of 1994. When Ronald Reagan announces to the world that he has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, there was something just incredibly powerful and poignant about seeing a facsimile of this letter in the book and realizing after all that he had experienced, such a glorious life in so many ways, that there was still nothing that could keep a thief like Alzheimer's at bay. I wonder if you could just say a word about this final chapter of Mr. Reagan's life and what it says about him and about his marriage to Nancy.
Well, you know, you're right. The letter, if anything is vintage classic Ronald Reagan, it's that letter. I mean, look at the handwriting. Look at the cross-outs. I would encourage people to look closely at the letter and see his handwriting and see that there's even some cross-outs in there, which is just, you know, no, nothing pretentious about it. That's how he was and who he was. And when the Reagans learned that he had Alzheimer's or was going to face Alzheimer's, they never hesitated for a moment, neither of them, to discuss it publicly. It's who they were and what they were about, because Mrs. Reagan, who was a doctor's daughter, her father was a very prominent neurosurgeon in Chicago, and her husband believed that if they spoke publicly about what they went through, it could help other people. And if you go back and look at their history, President Reagan was very honest about colon cancer. Mrs. Reagan was very honest and open about breast cancer. President Reagan was very honest and open about skin cancer, because they knew that the attention they got would end up helping people. And so the Alzheimer's decision was really one that they didn't even debate over. They knew immediately, instinctively, well, we have to tell people about this. And they decided to do so in a letter, which he wrote in his own hand of his own composition, and wanted to let people know what was what, because they felt that if they called attention to it, why maybe efforts could be increased to figure out a way to fix the disease, to cure it, even though it would clearly be too late for him. And it was just who they were.
Hmm. Ronald Reagan was Ronald Reagan even through this very last and sad chapter of what ultimately is such an impressive life, and told so beautifully in this really remarkable book, Ronald Reagan, 100 Years, produced under the auspices of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation, filled with wonderful photographs, many of them in color and many of them not seen before. And the author of the text, Mark Weinberg, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we are going to be talking state politics with Emily Kuhn. She is the creator of a voter app called One My Vote, which outlines all of the candidates running for all of these significant offices. It also offers a plethora of various resources for voters. We will be talking with her about some of the most important races here in the state of Wisconsin, including, of course, the race for governor, the first congressional race, the upcoming primary for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Tammy Baldwin, and much, much more. That'll be on tomorrow's morning show. On Monday, you'll hear my conversation recorded with best-selling author Earl Swift, whose most recent book is titled Chesapeake Requiem. In this book, Earl Swift talks about the people who live on the small island of Tangier in the Chesapeake Bay. It is an area in which some of the most beautiful and delicious crabs are found. But it is also a small island that is beleaguered by rising sea levels, a consequence almost certainly of climate change. And some very significant questions and are looming about what to do about an island like Tangier, which very likely within decades will be completely uninhabitable. And the choices that are confronting them are likely to be confronted by all kinds of small islands and coastal areas in the years to come. A really, really fascinating book, again titled